Have I ever failed to live up to my duties in any way?
Cersen held Galen's gaze. Nay, Galen admitted. Not yet, he added.
Nay,
Duncan said easily.
Then why do you question me now? Have I not far more experience with people, wars, and choices than any of you?
Galen nodded wryly.
But if you break your vow, how will you explain it to Adam?
Cersen stiffened. The words, "break your vow," lingered uncomfortably in his mind and wove a promise of failure, defeat, and potential for corruption. It was critical that he adhere to his rules.
Let me handle Adam, as I always have, he said coolly.
Galen shook his head.
The men will not like this, should they catch wind of it. You know the Templars are a fierce lot, and are particularly wary of women.
Because they can't have any,
Duncan interrupted.
They seek any reason to mistrust women in their effort to keep lustful thoughts at bay. A vow of celibacy is not natural for men. It makes them cold, irritable bastards. I, on the other hand, am always relaxed, even-tempered, and amiable.
He flashed a pleasant smile at them both, as if to prove the validity of his theory. Despite his problems, Cersen's mouth quirked. Duncan had a tendency to behave outrageously, and the more irreverent he was, the more irritated Galen became. Galen never seemed to realize that his younger brother did it on purpose, and the entire time Duncan was acting like an irresponsible youth, his astute Douglas mind wasn't missing a thing going on around him.
Lack of discipline does not a warrior make, little brother, Galen said stiffly. You are one extreme, and the Templars are the other.
Winching does not diminish my battle prowess one whit, and you know it,
Duncan said, sitting up straighter in his chair, his eyes sparkling in anticipation of the argument to come.
Enough, Cersen interrupted. We were discussing my oath, and the fact that I am forsworn to kill an innocent woman.
You do not know she is innocent,
Galen protested.
I do not know she is not, Cersen said. Until I have some indication of guilt or innocence, I...
He broke off and sighed heavily. He found it nearly impossible to say the next words.
You what?
Duncan asked, watching him with fascination. When Cersen didn't reply, he pushed.
Will you refuse to kill her? Will you break a forsworn oath?
Duncan's incredulity was etched all over his handsome face.
I didn't say that, Cersen snapped.
You didn't not say it, Galen said warily. I would appreciate it if you would clarify your intentions. Do you plan to kill her or not?
Cersen rubbed his jaw again. He cleared his throat, trying to form the words his conscience demanded he say, but the warrior in him resisted. Duncan's eyes narrowed as he regarded Cersen thoughtfully. After a moment, he glanced at his brother.
We know what Adam is like, Galen. His way has oft been swift, unnecessary destruction, and enough blameless lives have been taken in the quest to secure the throne. I propose Cersen take the time to discover who the woman is and when she comes prior to passing sentence. I cannot speak for you, Galen, but I do not wish the blood of another innocent on my hands. And if we urge him to kill her, the deed becomes ours as well. Besides, recall that although Cersen swore to kill the bearer of the flask, nothing in his oath addressed timeliness. He might wait 20 years to kill her without breaking his oath.
Cersen glanced up at Duncan's last words, surprised. He hadn't considered that possibility. In truth, his oath had not contained one word specifying how swiftly he must kill the bearer of the flask. Hence, it was neither amoral nor a violation of his oath to refrain for a short time in order to study the person. One might even argue that it was wise, he decided.
You split hairs with a battle axe.
Adam's words, from 6 years ago, surfaced in Cersen's mind to mock him.
But you had best be aware,
Galen warned,
that if you do not kill her, and should any of the Templars discover who she is, and the nature of the oath you swore,
the knights will lose faith in your ability to lead. They will see a vow broken as an unforgivable weakness. The only reason they agreed to fight for our country is because of you. Sometimes I think they would follow you into hell. You know they are fanatic in their beliefs. To them, there is no justification for breaking an oath. Ever.
Then we will not tell them who she is or what I swore, will we?
Cersen said softly, knowing the brothers would support his decision whether they agreed with it or not. The Douglases always stood behind the Laird and Thane of Brody. An ancient blood oath had united the two clans long ago. The brothers studied him, then nodded.
It will remain between us until you reach your decision.
Breathing deeply of the crisp, cool air, Cersen paced the courtyard while the woman waited in his chambers for mercy that was not his to grant. He struggled to harden himself against her. He had lived so long by the rules that he almost hadn't heard his conscience clamor when he'd raised his sword to her neck. While his warrior's training had insisted he honor the vow, a thing he had thought dead in him had undermined his resolution. Compassion. Sympathy. And an insidious little voice that had softly but relentlessly questioned the sagacity of his rules. He had recognized that voice. It was doubt, a thing he hadn't suffered for an eternity. "I swear to kill the bearer of the flask," he had pledged years ago. A warrior's oaths were his lifeblood, an unbreakable code by which he lived and died. Cersen Brody's rules were the only thing standing between him and a swift descent into chaos and corruption. What was the solution? She must die.
She?
By Dagda, how could it be a woman? Cersen liked women. He had adored his mother and treated all women with the same deference and courtesy. He felt women exhibited some of the best characteristics of humanity. Cersen was Brude, whose line of royal succession was matrilineal. Years ago, when Cersen had sworn his oath to Adam Black, he had not once considered that the flask might be found by a woman, and such a delightful one at that. When he'd torn the strange bonnet from her head, her thick hair had cascaded nearly to her waist in a fall of copper and gold highlights. Green eyes, up-tilted at the outer corners, had widened with fear, then quickly narrowed with anger as she'd pronounced the bonnet a gift from her da. It was only fitting that he return the family heirloom, no matter how ugly it was. Unusually tall for a woman, and lithe. Her breasts were full and firm, and he had glimpsed the press of her nipples against the thin fabric of her strange garment. Her legs were generously long, long enough to wrap around his waist and permit her to comfortably cross her ankles while he buried himself between them. When she had bent to retrieve her bonnet, he'd nearly snaked an arm around her waist, pulled her against him, and let his demanding nature take free rein. And then slit her throat when your desire was sated?
She.
Had Adam suspected that the bearer of the flask might be a female? Might he have seen into the future with his fairy vision and even now be laughing at his dilemma? Yet if he hadn't used a binding curse in the first place, the woman's life wouldn't be in danger now. It was his inept curse that had brought her here, and now he was supposed to kill the unsuspecting soul. Unless he found some proof of duplicity on her part, her death would be innocent blood on his hands that would haunt him for the rest of his life. Cersen girded his will, conceding that the best solution was to kill her. He would fulfill his oath. Then come tomorrow, life would be normal again. He would secure the flask in the secret place with the other Hallows and continue their war. He would return to his tidy regimen and find solace in knowing that he would never become the abomination he so feared he had the potential to be. Cersen Brody's primary goal was to see the Bruce securely on the throne of Scotland. Upon the English King Longshanks' death, his son, Edward II, had continued his father's war, relentlessly chipping away at Scotland's heritage. Soon nothing of their unique culture would remain. They would be Britons, weak and obedient, taxed into starvation and submission. Their greatest hope against the ruthless King of England was the renegade Templars who had sought sanctuary at Castle Brody. Cerson blew out a breath of frustration. The persecution of the Templars grieved and infuriated him. He had once considered joining the renowned order of warrior monks, but some of their rules hadn't been quite to his taste. He'd settled instead for working closely with the religious knights, since both he and the order protected hallowed artifacts of immense value and power. Cerson respected the order's many causes and knew its history as well as any Templar. The order had been founded in 1118, when a group of 9 predominantly French knights had gone to Jerusalem and petitioned King Baudouin to allow them to live in the ancient ruin of the Temple of Solomon. In exchange, the 9 knights had offered their services to protect pilgrims traveling to the Holy Land from robbers and murderers along the public highways leading into Jerusalem. In 1128, the Pope had given his official approval to the order. The knights had been handsomely paid for their services, and the order had increased dramatically in numbers, wealth, and power through the 12th and 13th centuries. By the 14th century, the order owned over 9,000 manors and castles across Europe. Independent of royal or episcopal control, the order's profits were free of taxation. The order's many estates were farmed, producing revenues that served as the basis for the largest financing system in Europe. In the 13th and 14th centuries, the Parisian Order of the Templars virtually functioned as the French royal treasury, lending large sums to European royalty and individual nobles. However, as the Templars' wealth and power increased, so did the suspicion and jealousy among some members of the nobility. Cerson hadn't been surprised when the order's success became the very reason for its downfall. He'd anticipated it, yet had been helpless to prevent it. The politics of Pope and King were too mighty for one man to influence. Cerson recalled well how, nearly a dozen years past, the Templars' wealth had drawn the deadly attention of the French king, Philippe the Fair, who was desperate to line his coffers. In 1305, Philippe maligned the order, convincing Pope Clement V that the Templars were not holy defenders of the Catholic faith, but rather seeking to destroy it. Philippe campaigned exhaustively against the knights and accused the Templars of heinous acts of heresy and sacrilege. In 1307, the Pope gave the king the order he'd been waiting for, the right to arrest all the Templars in France, to confiscate their properties, and to direct an inquisition. So the infamous bloody and biased trial of the Templars had begun. Cerson ran a hand through his hair and scowled. Knights had been arrested, imprisoned, and forced through torture to confess to sins of Philippe's choosing. Even more had been burned at the stake. In trial, the knights had been permitted no defense advocates. They had not even been allowed to know the names of their accusers and witnesses against them. The so-called trial had been a witch hunt, deviously orchestrated to strip the Templars of their fabulous riches. Adding insult to injury, the Pope had issued a papal bull that suppressed the order and denied it recognition. The few knights who managed to escape imprisonment or death had become outcasts, without country or home. When Cerson had realized the knight's downfall was inevitable, he had hastened to meet with Robert the Bruce, and, with Robert's approval, had sent word to the order that they would be welcomed in Scotland. Robert had offered them sanctuary, and in return, the powerful warrior monks had turned their fighting skills to the battle against England. The Templars were formidable warriors, trained in weaponry and strategy, and they were essential to Scotland's cause. Over the past few years, Cerson had been stealthily slipping them into the Bruce's troops as commanders, with the Bruce's assent. Already the Scots were warring better, implementing cunning strategies, and winning minor battles. Cerson knew that if he faltered now, if he began to break oaths or did anything that jeopardized the Templars' loyalty, he might as well throw away the past 10 years of his life, along with his love for his motherland. Lisa had no idea how much time had passed since she'd sat on the floor. But it was long enough for her to realize that time didn't pass in such a fashion for dreamers. If one sat still in a dream and did nothing, the dream either ended or moved on to some new and incredible adventure colored by shades of the absurd. absurd like the proportions of that man's body, she thought irritably. Pushing herself up from the floor with her hands, she paused in a crouch, observing the wide, flat stones beneath her palms, cool, hard, dry with a skimming of stone dust, entirely too tangible. Rising to her feet, she began to examine her surroundings. The chamber was large, lit by fat, soapy candles. The walls, fashioned of massive stone blocks, were hung with random tapestries. A huge bed occupied the center of the room, and several chests were scattered about with neatly folded fabrics piled atop them. The room was spartan, tidy. The fireplace was the only concession to atmosphere. There was not a single woman's touch in the room. Pausing near the bathtub, she dipped her hand in the water. Tepid. Another sensation too tangible to deny. She moved to the fireplace and flinched at the confoundingly real sensation of warmth. She studied the flames a moment, marveling that the rest of the room was so chilly when the hearth was throwing off such a blaze. It was as if the fire were the sole source of heat, she thought. Struck by that notion, she briskly walked the perimeter of the room. Her suspicion was quickly confirmed. There was not one heating vent in the entire chamber, no radiators in the corners collecting dust, no little metal vents in the floors, no pipes, or for that matter, a single electrical outlet, no phone jacks, no closets. The door was made of what looked like solid oak, no hollow core veneer there. She took a deep, calming breath and assured herself that she must have overlooked something, at least in terms of the heating. Circling the room a second time, she surveyed every nook and cranny as she trailed her hand along the wall, another way of testing the solidity of her prison. Her fingertips brushed a thick tapestry that yielded beneath them, and felt far colder than the stones. The rough fabric shivered beneath her palm as if the wind were batting at it from the other side. Mystified, she tugged it aside. She lost her breath in a sudden rush of air. The view from the window struck her as intensely as an unexpected blow to her stomach. She gazed out upon a misty night from ancient history. 50 feet above the ground, she was in a stone castle that stood on an island promontory surrounded by a thundering sea. Waves hurled themselves at the rocky crags, breaking into foam and becoming one with the mist that swirled up from the black surface of the ocean. On a cobbled walkway, men carrying torches moved silently between the castle and small outbuildings. The distant cry of a wolf competed with faint strains of bagpipes. The night sky was blue-black, tinted purple where it met the water, dancing with thousands of stars and a thin scythe of a moon. She'd never seen so many constellations in Cincinnati. Smog and the halo effect of the brilliantly lit city dimmed such beauty. The view from the window was breathtakingly stark, majestic. A bitter wind howled up from the sea and across the promontory, buffeting the tapestry in her hand. She dropped it as if she'd been burned, and it fell across the window, blessedly sealing out the inexplicable vista. Unfortunately, as her eyes focused on the tapestry, she discovered a new horror. It was brilliantly woven and far too detailed. A warrior, riding a horse into battle while an army of men clad in blood-stained plaid cheered. At the bottom of the hanging, embroidered in crimson, were 4 numbers that chipped away at her sanity. 1314. Lisa moved to the bed and sank limply onto it, her energy sapped by the successive shocks. She stared blankly at the bed for a moment. Then her hand flashed out and poked frantically at the mattress as she tested another part of her environment.
Not your run-of-the-mill sort of sleeper here, Lisa.
Filled with a growing sense of panic, she pulled back the tightly tucked blankets and was momentarily sidetracked by the fragrance that clung to the linens. His scent. Spice. Danger. And man. Firmly ignoring a desire to bury her nose in the sheets, she tugged at the mattress, which was little more than thin pallets laid atop one another encased in bristly fabric. One crunched like dried brush. The next seemed stuffed with lumpy woolly stuff, and the top had the feel of limp feathers. For the next 20 minutes, Lisa scrutinized her surroundings, driven by increasing desperation. The stones felt cool, the fire felt hot. The liquid in the cup near the bed tasted vile. She heard the bagpipes. Every sense she possessed was activated by her tests. Absently, she swiped at her neck with the back of her hand, and when she drew it away, a single drop of blood lay crimson upon her skin. She understood with sudden certainty that she should never have touched the flask. Although it defied rational explanation, she was neither in Cincinnati nor in the 21st century. She felt the last of her hope that she was dreaming slip from her tenuous grasp. Dreams she knew well, but this was too real to be a dream, detailed far beyond her mind's ability to fabricate.
"Give me the flask," he demanded.
"You see this? This is part of the dream?"
She'd been astonished. But now, reflecting upon it, she realized that he'd seen it because it was not part of a dream. It was part of reality, his reality, a reality she now shared. That it was the flask she had touched just before she'd started to feel like she was falling, and the flask that he'd demanded seemed too logical a connection to exist within a dream. Had the flask somehow carried her back to a man who had direct or indirect proprietary rights to it? And if so, was she truly in the 14th century? With growing horror, she saw the frightening pattern. His odd manner of dress, his intent perusal of her clothing as if he'd never seen the like before, the primitive wooden tubs situated before the fire, the strange language he'd spoken, the tapestry on the wall, all of it hinted at the impossible. Stricken, she glanced around the room, reassessing it from a different perspective. She viewed it as her employment in the museum had led her to believe a medieval chamber would appear. And all the oddities made perfect sense. Logic insisted she was in a medieval stone castle, and according to the wall hanging, at some point in the 14th century, despite the improbability of it. Lisa blew her breath out in a frantic attempt to calm down. She couldn't be somewhere else in time, because if this was medieval Scotland, Catherine was some 700 years in the future, alone. Her mother desperately needed her and had no one else to rely on. That was unacceptable. Being stuck in a strange dream was now relegated to the minor problem it would have been, had it been true. A dream would have been easy to manage. Eventually she would have awakened, no matter how awful things had been in the dream. If she was actually in the past, which was what all her senses insisted, she had to get back home. But how? Would touching the flask do it again? As she pondered that possibility, she heard footsteps in the corridor outside the chamber. She moved quickly to the door, debated cowering behind it, then pressed her ear to it instead. It would be wise to discover everything she could about her environment.
"Do you think he'll do it?"
a voice echoed in the hall. There was a long silence, then a sigh so loud that it carried through the thick wood.
"I believe so. He does not take oaths lightly, and he knows the woman must die. Nothing can come in the way of our cause, Duncan. Don Otter must be held, that bastard Edward must be defeated, and oaths sworn must be honored. He will kill her."
As the steps faded down the corridor, Lisa leaned limply against the door. There was no doubt in her mind exactly which woman they'd meant. Dunatar? Edward? Dear God, she hadn't merely traveled through time. She'd been dropped smack into the sequel to Braveheart. Chapter 4. It was late at night when Sirson quietly eased his chamber door open a few inches. Peering through the narrow aperture, he saw that the room was dark. Only a faint bar of moonlight fell from behind the tapestry. She must be sleeping, he decided, which would give him the advantage of surprise. He would get this over with quickly. He swung the door open, stepped into the room with swift conviction, and promptly lost his footing. As he hit the floor of his chamber, he cursed. It had been cunningly littered with sharp pieces of broken stoneware. He scarcely had time to register that he'd tripped over a taut and cleverly tied cord when he was smashed on the back of the head with a stoneware basin.
"By God, the lass!"
he roared, rolling over on his side and clutching his head.
"Are you trying to kill me?"
"Of course I am," she hissed.
Sirson could discern nothing more than a blur of motion in the darkness when, much to his astonishment and pain, she kicked him in a most sensitive part of his body, a part most women touched reverently. When he doubled over, his hands grazed more of the jagged shards on the floor, and he winced. She leaped over his body like a frightened doe, bounding for the open doorway. Deadening himself to the pain, he moved swiftly. His hand flashed out and fastened on her ankle.
"Leave this room, and you are dead," he said flatly. "My men will kill you the moment they see you."
"So what's the difference? You will too," she cried. "Let go of me!"
She kicked ineffectually at the hand clasped around her ankle. He growled and banged the door shut with his foot. Then, pulling on her ankle, he caused her to lose her balance and brought her crashing down on top of him. He tried to roll her toward him as she fell to keep her from striking any of the stoneware she'd so deviously strewn about, but she bucked as she hit him and bounced over his side. A grapple ensued, and she fought him with a surprising amount of courage and strength. Aware of his superior brawn, he focused his efforts on subduing her without hurting her or allowing her to harm herself. If anyone was going to be harming her, it was he. They wrestled in silence, except for his grunts when she landed a particularly painful shot, and her gasps when he finally captured her hands and held them above her head and stretched her on her back on the floor. His grasp nearly slipped when his hand closed around a band of metal on her wrist. As he forcefully restrained her arms, it slipped off, and he closed his fist over it, then placed it in his sporran for later inspection. It might yield clues to her identity. He deliberately let the full weight of his body settle atop hers, knowing she would not be able to breathe. "Submit," he willed silently as she bucked against him, trying to win her freedom.
"I am stronger than you, lass. Cede this battle to me. Do not be foolish."
"And let you kill me? Never! I heard your men!"
She panted, trying to draw air into her lungs while crushed beneath his weight. Sirson scowled. So that was why she'd laid a trap for him. She must have overheard Galen and Duncan as they'd retired to their rooms. They'd obviously said something about his killing her. He'd have to speak with those two about discretion, perhaps encourage them to revert to Gaelic while within the walls of the keep. He suffered a momentary lapse in concentration while admiring her resourcefulness, and she exploited it by bashing her forehead into his chin, and it hurt. He shook her forcefully and was astonished when the woman didn't yield, but tried to headbutt him again. She showed no signs of giving up the fight, and he realized that she would beat at him until she passed out from lack of breath. Since the only part of their respective bodies they both had free were their heads, he did the only thing he could think of. He kissed her. It would be impossible for her to headbutt him with her lips pressed against his, and he'd learned long ago that the best way to control a fight was to get as far into his enemy's space as possible. It took nerves of steel to handle 6 feet and 7 inches of ruthless Brody a breath away from one's heart. While congratulating himself for the inventive strategy he'd employed to keep her from hitting him with the only part of her body she could move, he acknowledged his attempt at self-deceit. He had wanted to kiss her since the moment she'd materialized in front of his bath, yet another violation of his careful rules. He knew that physical intimacy with this woman might skew his impartiality, but their skirmish had brought him into contact with every inch of her body. Her curves were pressed against his hard length as if they were naked together, and her fierce, intelligent ambush had aroused him even more than her beauty had. He had the scent of her in his nostrils, fear and woman and fury. It made him rock hard. He sought to subdue her with his kiss, to make her understand his complete dominance, but the crush of her breasts beneath his chest heated him, and he found himself plunging his tongue between her lips with the intention of seducing rather than conquering. He sensed the moment when his kisses stopped being his way of controlling her and became nothing but a savage desire to indulge his appetite for the woman. All he need do was push aside his plaid, peel off her strange trousers and push himself inside her. The temptation was exquisite. His breathing quickened, sounding harsh to his own ears. It had been too long since he'd been with a woman, and his body was tightly strung. He angled himself away, drawing back to stop the painful press of his arousal against the cradle of her hips. When she went motionless beneath him, he girded his will. Loath to lose the fullness of her lower lip, he sucked it hard as he drew away. He gazed down at her. Her eyes were closed, her lashes dark fans against her cheeks.
"Are you going to kill me now?"
she whispered. Sersin stared at her, conflicting directives warring within him. In their tussle, he'd freed his dirk, and now he laid it against her throat. One swift plunge and it would be over. Brief, merciful, simple. His oath would be fulfilled, and there would be naught to do but remove the lass with the torn neck and forever silenced heart, and return to his carefully orchestrated world. Her eyes widened in alarm as she felt the chill metal brush against her skin. He made the mistake of gazing into them. He closed his eyes and clenched his jaw. "Cut!" he ordered himself, but his fingers didn't so much as tense around the handle of the short knife. "Cut!" he raged at himself. Perversely, his body hardened against her, and he felt a sudden wave of desire to drop the knife and kiss her again. "Kill her now!" he commanded himself. Not a finger flinched. The knife lay useless against her skin.
"I can't die now," she whispered. "I haven't even lived yet."
The muscles in his arm recognized defeat before his mind did. There were no other words she could have said that would have dismayed him more. "I haven't even lived yet." An eloquent plea to taste what life had to offer, and whether she realized it or not, quite revealing. It told him much about her. His arm relaxed, and he removed the knife from her throat with far greater ease than he'd placed it there. He muttered a curse as he flung it across the room, and it sank into the door with a satisfying sound.
"Nay, lass, I will not kill you."
"Not tonight," he appended silently. He would question her, study her, determine her involvement, judge her, guilty or innocent. If he found evidence of subterfuge or a shallow and avaricious personality, his blade would easily find the mark, he assured himself. "I need to ask you some questions. If I let you up, will you sit quietly on the bed and answer me?"
"Yes. I can't breathe,"
she added.
"Hurry."
Sersin shifted so his weight was not resting fully on her. He allowed her to regain her freedom in regulated stages, so she understood that he was giving it to her. It was neither a freedom she had earned, nor one she could ever hope to take. He granted her passage, permitted her range of motion. It was imperative she understand that his control over her was absolute. Despite his uncomfortable state of arousal, he forced her to keep close contact as she slipped her body from beneath his. It was a purely male show of dominance. He scarcely gave her room enough to find her knees beneath her. He leaned back minutely, so she was forced to falter to her feet by clutching his shoulders, which put her lips a mere breath away from his. He would be all over her until she acquiesced to his dictates. She kept her gaze defiantly averted, refusing to look at him while she used his body to pull herself up.
"Had you met my gaze, lass, I would have pushed you farther," he thought.
For had she still possessed enough defiance to meet his eyes, he would have provoked submission some other way. He rose in tandem with her, so their bodies touched at many contact points, and didn't miss her swift intake of breath when he deliberately shifted, so her breasts brushed against his abdomen. He backed her to the bed, and with one gentle push, seated her upon it. Then he turned his back on her as if she were nothing, no threat, insignificant. Another lesson she must learn. He had nothing to fear from her. He could turn his back on her with impunity. His movement had the secondary boon of giving him time to quell his desire. He took several deep breaths, bolted the door from the inside, and whipped his dirk from the wood and slapped it into his boot. He lit tapers before turning back to face her. By then, he was breathing evenly, and his plaid was carefully bunched at the front. She didn't need to know what toll their enforced closeness had taken on him. She had buried her face in her hands, and her coppery hair slipped in a glossy fall across her knees. He reminded himself not to look at her long legs in those revealing trousers, scarcely concealed by the pale blue fabric. A man could follow the slim line of her ankles over muscled calves and up shapely thighs to the V of her woman's privacy. Those trousers could seduce a Templar Grand Master. "Who are you?" he began quietly. He would continue in a gentle voice until she demonstrated resistance. Then he might roar at her. With a small measure of amusement, he conceded the probability that this lass would roar back.
"My name is Lisa,"
she murmured into her palms. A good start, obedient and swift.
"Lisa, I am Sersin Brody. Would that we had met under different circumstances. But we did not, and we must make the best of it. Where did you find my flask?"
"In the museum where I work,"
she said in a monotone.
"What is a museum?"
"A place that displays treasures and artifacts."
"My flask was on display? For people to see?"
he asked indignantly, thinking, hadn't the curse worked?
"No, it had just been found. It was still in the chest. It hadn't been placed on display yet."
She didn't raise her head from her hands.
"Ah, so the chest had not been opened. You were the first one to touch it."
"No, two men touched it before I did."
"You saw them touch it? Truly touch the flask?"
She was silent for a long moment.
"Oh my God, the tongs!"
she exclaimed. Her head shot up and she stared at him with an expression of horror.
"No, I didn't actually see them touch it, but there was a pair of tongs lying next to the chest. I'll bet Steinman and his cohort never touched the chest or the flask at all. Is that what did this to me? Touching the flask? I knew I shouldn't have pried into business that wasn't mine."
"This is very important, lass. You must answer me truthfully. Do you know what the flask contains?"
She gave him a look of utter innocence. She was either the consummate actress or was telling the truth.
"No. What?"
Actress or innocent? He rubbed his jaw while he scrutinized her.
"Where are you from, lass? England?"
"No, Cincinnati."
Where is that?"
"In the United States."
"But you speak English."
"Our people fled from England several hundred years ago. Once my countrymen were English, now we call ourselves American."
Sersin regarded her blankly. A look of sudden revelation crossed her face, and he wondered at it.
"That was silly of me. Of course you couldn't possibly understand. The United States is far across the sea from Scotland," she said. "We didn't like England either, so I can empathize,"
she said reassuringly.
"You've probably never heard of my land, but I'm from very far away, and it's imperative that I get back, soon."
When he shook his head, her jaw tightened, and Sersin felt a flash of admiration. The lass was a fighter to the last. He suspected that if he had attempted to kill her, there would have been no pleas from her lips, but vows of vengeance to the bitter finale.
"I am afraid I cannot send you back just now."
"But you can send me back at some point. You know how?"
She held her breath, awaiting his reply.
"I am certain we can manage,"
he said noncommittally. If she was from a land across the sea, and if he could find a way to accept not killing her, he could surely find a ship to put her on if it was decided that she could be released. The fact that she was from so far away might make it easier for him to free her, because it was doubtful her homeland had any interest in Scotland. And once she was gone, Perhaps he could force himself to forget he'd broken a rule. Out of sight might well be out of mind. Her appearance in the keep could truly have been a vast mistake. But how had his chest gotten to a land so far away?
How did your museum obtain my chest?
They send people all over looking for unusual treasures.
Who are they?
He asked quickly. Perhaps she was innocent, but perhaps the men she'd mentioned were not.
My employers.
Her gaze flickered to his, then away. He narrowed his eyes and studied her thoughtfully. Why had she averted her gaze? She seemed to be making a genuine effort to communicate with him. Although he saw no sign of outright deception, he sensed strong emotions in her. There were things she was not saying. As he pondered the direction of his inquisition, she stunned him by saying,
"So, how do you send me through time? Is it magic?"
Sirson released a soft whistle. By Dagda, how far had this last come? Chapter 5. Lisa sat on the bed, anxiously awaiting his reply. She found it difficult to look at him, partly because he frightened her, and partly because he was so damn beautiful. How was she supposed to think of him as the enemy when her body, without even briefly consulting her mind, had already decided to like him? She'd never felt such a visceral, instant attraction. Lying beneath his overwhelming body, she'd been flooded with a frantic sexual desire that she'd hastily attributed to fear of dying. She'd read somewhere that happened sometimes. She forced herself to remain motionless, so she would betray neither the panic she felt nor her unacceptable fascination with him. In the past few minutes, she'd been transported from fear and rage that her life might end so inauspiciously to astonishment when he'd kissed her. Now she settled into wary numbness. She realized the man had some seriously intimidating body language, that he was in complete control, and unless she could catch him unaware, she didn't have a chance of escaping. She had already blown her best opportunity to catch him off guard when she'd ambushed him at the door. He was well over 6.5 feet tall, more massive than any professional football player she'd ever seen, and she wouldn't have been surprised if he weighed in at 300+ pounds of solid muscle. This man didn't miss a thing. He was a natural-born predator and warrior, scrutinizing her every move and expression. She fancied that he could smell her emotions. Didn't animals attack when they scented fear?
I see I must approach this from a different angle, lass. When are you from?
She forced herself to look at him. He'd lowered himself to the floor and was leaning back against the door, his powerful bare legs outstretched in front of him. The jeweled handle of his knife protruded from his boots. There was blood trickling down his temple, and his lower lip was swollen. When he wiped absently at it with the back of his hand, tendons and muscles rippled in his forearm.
"You're bleeding,"
the inane comment slipped from her mouth. "And wearing a tartan," she marveled. An actual plaid, woven of crimson and black, draped about his body, carelessly revealing much more than it concealed. The corner of his lip curved.
"Imagine that," he mocked. "I was ambushed by a spitting banshee, and now I am bleeding. I was tripped, bashed in the head, rolled over broken stoneware, headbutted, kicked in the..."
"I'm sorry."
"You should be."
"You were trying to kill me,"
Lisa said defensively.
"How dare you get mad at me when I was mad at you first? You started it!"
He ran an impatient hand through his hair.
"Aye, and now I am ending it. I told you I have decided not to kill you for the moment, but I require information from you. I have 50 men outside this door."
He gestured over his shoulder with a thumb. "Who will need reasons to trust you and let you live.
Although I am the laird here, I cannot keep you safe all the time if I do not give my men plausible reasons why you are not a threat."
"Why do any of you want to kill me in the first place?"
Lisa asked.
"What have I done?"
"I am in charge of this inquiry, lass."
With deliberate leisure, he folded his arms across his chest. Lisa had no doubt that he'd struck the pose to make a point. It made all the muscles in his arms bunch and reminded her how small she was compared to him, even at 5'10". She'd just learned another lesson. He could be courteous, even demonstrate a droll sense of humor, but he was always deadly, always in command.
Right, she said tightly. But it might help if I understood why you consider me a threat to begin with.
Because of what is in the flask.
What's in it?
She asked, then berated herself for her incessant curiosity. Unchecked curiosity had created this situation.
If you dunno know, your innocence will protect you. Dunna ask me again.
Lisa blew out a nervous breath.
When are you from?
He asked softly, circling back to his initial question.
The 21st century.
He blinked and cocked his head.
You expect me to believe you are from a time 700 years from now?
You expect me to believe that I'm in the 14th century?
She said, unable to conceal a note of peevishness in her voice. Why did he expect such madness to be any easier for her to deal with? A quick smile flashed across his face, and she breathed more easily, but then the smile vanished, and he was again the remote savage.
This conversation is not about you, lass, or what you think, or what you believe. It is about me, and whether I can find a reason to trust you and let you live. Your being from the future and your feelings about being here mean nothing to me. It is irrelevant where or when you are from. The fact is that you are here now, and you have become my problem. And I do not like problems.
So send me home, she said in a small voice. That should solve your problem.
She flinched as his intense gaze fixed on her face. His dark eyes latched onto hers, and for a space of time unmeasured, she couldn't look away.
If you are from the future, who is Scotland's king?
He asked silkily. She drew a cautious breath.
I'm afraid I don't know. I've never followed politics, she lied.
She certainly wasn't about to tell a warrior who was fighting over kings and territories that 700 years from now Scotland still didn't have a recognized king. She might not have a college degree, but she wasn't a complete fool. His eyes narrowed, and she suffered the uncanny sensation that he was gauging far more than her facial expressions. Finally, he said,
I accept that. Few women follow politics, but perhaps you know your history, he encouraged softly.
Do you know yours from 700 years ago?
Lisa evaded, quickly intuiting where he was headed. He would want to know who won what battle and who fought where, and the next thing she knew, she'd be all tangled up in screwing up the future. If she really was in the past, she was not going to participate in instigating world chaos.
Much of it? He said arrogantly.
Well, I don't. I'm just a woman,
she said with as much guilelessness as she could muster. He regarded her appraisingly, and the corner of his lip lifted in a half-smile.
Ah, lass, you are decidedly not just a woman. I suspect it would be a vast mistake to deem you merely anything. Have you a clan?
What?
To which clan do you belong?
When she didn't answer, he said,
Do you have clans in Cincinnati?
No,
Lisa said succinctly. He certainly didn't have to worry about someone trying to rescue her. She hardly had a family anymore. Hers was a clan of two, and one was dying. He made an impatient gesture with his hands.
Your clan name, lass, that is all I am after. Lisa what?
Oh, you want to know my last name? Stone. Lisa Stone.
His eyes widened incredulously.
Like rock? Or boulder?
No half-smile this time. A full grin curved his lips, and the impact was devastating. Her fingers itched with the urge to smack it off. Enemy, she reminded herself.
No, like Sharon Stone, the famous actress, she added at his blank look.
His eyes narrowed.
You descend from a line of actresses?
he demanded. What on earth had she said wrong?
No, she sighed. That was my attempt at a joke, but it wasn't funny because you don't know who I meant. My last name is Stone, though.
How foolish do you think I am?
He echoed the exact words she'd said to him about his name only hours ago.
Lisa Rock, that will not do. I can hardly present you to my men, should I decide to, as Lisa Stone. I may as well tell them you are Lisa Mud or Lisa Straw. Why would your people take the name of a stone?
It's a perfectly respectable name, she said stiffly. I've always thought it a strong name, like me, capable of enduring calamity, mighty and able. Stones have a certain majesty and mystery. You should know that, being from Scotland. Aren't your stones sacred?
He mulled over her words a moment and nodded.
There is that. I had not considered it as such, but our stones are beautiful and treasured monuments to our heritage. Lisa Stone it is. Did your museum say where they found my chest?
He coolly resumed his inquisition. Lisa reflected, trying to recall the discussion she'd overheard as she'd hidden beneath Steinman's desk.
Buried in some rocks near a riverbank in Scotland.
Ah, it begins to make sense, he murmured. It did not occur to me when I cursed it that if my chest went undiscovered for centuries, the person who touched it would have to travel through both terrain and time.
He shook his head.
I have little patience for this cursing business.
It would also seem you have little aptitude for it.
The words tumbled from her mouth before she could stop them.
It worked, did it not?
He said stiffly.
Shut up, Lisa, she warned herself, but her tongue paid no heed. Well, yes, but you can't judge something simply by its outcome. The end does not necessarily justify the means.
He smiled faintly. My mother was inclined to say that.
Mother.
Lisa closed her eyes. God, how she wished she could keep them closed and maybe it would all go away. No matter how fascinating this was, how gorgeous he was. She had to get out of there. Even as they spoke, somewhere in the future the night nurse was being relieved by the day nurse, and her mother would have expected her home hours ago. Who would check her medicines to be certain the nurses had gotten the doses right? Who would hold her hand while she slept, so if she slipped away she wouldn't die alone? Who would cook her favorite foods to tempt her appetite?
"Curse me back," she pleaded.
He regarded her intently, and she again suffered the sensation of being examined on a deeper level. His gaze was a nearly tangible pressure. After a long silence, he said,
I cannot send you back, lass. I do not know how.
What do you mean, you don't know how?
She exclaimed.
Wouldn't touching the flask do it?
He jerked his head in a sharp gesture of negation.
That is not the flask's power. Traveling through time, if indeed you did, was an incidental part of the curse. I do not know how to send you back home. When you said you were from across the sea, I thought I could put you on a ship and sail you home. But your home is 700 years from happening.
So curse something else to send me back,
she cried.
Lass, it does not work like that. Curses are wily little creatures, and none can command time.
So what are you going to do with me?
She asked faintly. He rose to his feet, his face devoid of expression, and he was once again warrior lord, icy and remote.
I will tell you when I have decided, lass.
She dropped her head in her hands and didn't need to look up to know he was leaving the room and locking her in again. It offended her that he was so much in control of her, and she felt an overwhelming need to have the last word. Childish, though the impulse was, she decided that making small demands early on might strengthen her position.
Well, are you going to starve me?
She yelled at the closed door. She also learned years ago that mustering defiance could prevent tears from spilling. Sometimes anger was the only defense one had. She wasn't certain if she heard a rumble of laughter, or if she imagined it. Chapter 6. Lisa woke with sore, knotted muscles and a kink in her neck from sleeping without a pillow, sensations so tangible they shouted, "Welcome to reality!" She was surprised she'd managed to fall asleep at all, but exhaustion had finally overcome her paranoia. She'd slept in her clothes, and her jeans were stiff and uncomfortable. She was cold. Her T-shirt was twisted around her neck, her bra had come unsnapped, and her lower back ached from the lumpy mattresses. She sighed and rolled over onto her back, stretching gingerly. She had slept, dreamed anxious, eerie dreams, and awakened to the same stone chamber. That sealed it. This was no dream. Had she any residual doubts, they disintegrated in the pale light of dawn that lined the edges of the gently blowing tapestries. No nightmare could have conjured the nauseating food she'd choked down late last night, nor in any dream would she have subconsciously surrounded herself with such primitive amenities. Fertile though her imagination was, it was not sadistic. Although, she reflected, Sirson Brody was indisputably the stuff of dreams. He'd kissed her. He'd lowered his mouth to hers, and the touch of his tongue had sent heat lancing through her body, despite her fear. She'd trembled, actually shaken from head to toe when his lips had bruised hers. She'd read about things like that happening, but never thought to experience it. Before she'd fallen asleep last night, she had filed every detail of the kiss away in her memory, a priceless artifact in the barren museum of her life. Why had he kissed her? He was so intent and controlled, she had imagined that if he ever touched a woman, it would have been with a disciplined caress, not such a kiss as he'd given her, one that had been wild, hot, and uninhibited, bordering on savage, yet infinitely seductive. Made a woman want to toss her head back and whimper with pleasure while he ravished her. He was skilled, and she knew she was out of her league with Sirson Brody. It must have been a strategy, she decided. The man dripped strategies. Perhaps he'd thought to seduce her into compliance. Given his appearance, coupled with the dark sexuality he exuded, he probably controlled women all his life in such a fashion.
"Somebody, anybody, please help me," she whispered softly. "I'm in way over my head."
Pushing the memory of his kiss far from her mind, she stretched her arms over her head, testing for bruises from their skirmish last night. When she heard a scrabbling at the door and the sound of the bolt being slid, she squeezed her eyes shut, pretending she was asleep. She was not ready to face him this morning.
"Well, come on with ye, lassie. You will not escape by being a lie about in bed all day,"
said a mischievous voice. Lisa's eyes flew open. A boy stood beside her, peering down.
"Och! Aren't ye the bonniest lassie?"
he exclaimed. The lad had auburn hair, a gammon grin, and unusually dark eyes and skin. His chin was pointy, his cheekbones high. Quite a fey-looking child, she thought.
"Come, follow me,"
he cried. When he darted from the room, Lisa tossed back the covers and dashed out the door behind him without a second thought. Heavens, the boy was quick! She had to stretch her long legs to keep pace as he skimmed over the stones toward a door at the end of the dim corridor.
"Here, quickly!"
he cried as he ducked through the doorway. Had it been anyone but a child, she would never have blindly followed, but waking up and being granted a chance to escape by an innocent child overrode her common sense, and she found herself trailing him into a small turret. As she ducked in, he closed the door swiftly. They stood in a circular stone room, with stairs winding both up and down. When he grabbed her hand and started to pull her down the stairs, Lisa's eyes narrowed suspiciously. Who was this child, and why was he intent on helping her flee? She resisted his grip so suddenly that he stumbled backward.
"Wait a minute."
She held him by the shoulders.
"Who are you?"
The boy shrugged innocently, dislodging her grip.
"Me? Just a wee lad who has the run of the keep. Dinna fash yourself, lassie, no one notices me. I've come to help you escape."
"Why?"